Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also sponsors the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. Dogs across America are trying this food and experiencing amazing health benefits. Go to badlandsranch.com/save50 and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to badlandsranch.com/save50 today.
You're listening to Power Athlete Radio, a podcast dedicated to empowering your performance every damn day. Join former NFL pro and Power Athlete founder John Wellborn as he dissects the greatest minds in strength, conditioning, and more. So whether your goal is to be the hammer, destroy mediocrity, or simply move the dirt, you've come to the right place. Now with the warm-up done, let the gains begin.
Hey, Power Athlete Nation, I have a podcast that is a long time in the making. I think I got first connected with Coach Jameson over 10 years ago through our good friend Rob Wolf about coming on and discussing HRV in some of the training, especially as I got more into developing an aerobic system for 22 Jack Street, which was the precursor to the program Jack Street. So finally reached out as we've been using Joel's technology, Morpheus, to work with Victor and some of the fighters and to be able to track HRV. I'm not overly romanced with real-time HRV, so I wanted a specific score and ended up, you know, deciding to use Morpheus for the training, which is his company and the technology they use. And it's been extremely beneficial in terms of managing load and volume and seeing the different levels of intensity the guys have been training in. So reached out, got him on the podcast, came on and did not disappoint. We went through not only Morpheus, HRV, but what he had done. And Joel is an extremely well-vetted coach and somebody that was early in the game, especially with understanding heart rate and how you can train into these different zones. So not only an excellent conversation, very happy to connect with him. And I feel like the culmination of a long time coming, having him on Power Athlete Radio. So buckle up, Joel Jameson. Well, so what I did is I actually ordered the Morpheus for them, and at least then I would have, like, because I'm not overly romanced with, like, at-the-minute HRV. You know, you wear the whoop, you wear all these things, and it's giving you by-the-minute HRV, and for athletes, I think it's the worst thing because they're looking at it all the time, and then they're trying to do some mental gymnastics of, like, oh, am I recovered? I don't want them to do it. All I want them to do is once a week, Monday morning, I want you to do your HRV, and then maybe one or two other times during the week after we do all of our big conditioning stuff, I would have them do it. And then at least it would give me a number for them to shoot for. So when they wear the straps, when they roll, I can kind of gauge what the energy systems are hitting. And it's like this, like it's either, you know, 95% or like way down. It's so up and down. And it was just like they were so deficient in that, like, you know, zone one, zone two, 130, 140 beats a minute in that area. I mean, they were high register guys or like zero.
And that's super common in that sport.
Yeah. And they just never had lifted weights. So when they came in, I was like, holy shit, dude, like this is legitimate beginners, like basic linear progression. It was wild.
I mean, the first guy I ever tested, Diamond Salivary, came in, he could do like maybe two pull-ups. Like couldn't squat his body weight. I was like, Jesus, this guy is so damn weak. And there's a point where like more strength's not better, but they're starting at such a low point. Like you can make a pretty big difference. Just get him on the most basic program of all time, because that's all they can do. It's all they really need when they first get started. Because like you said, they are like beginners. They've just got no experience.
Yeah,
a lot of them don't like it. It's the hard part too, especially like the Brazilians. Brazilians, like, you know, they just don't want it. They want to roll.
I've shamed them into liking lifting weights. So really? Yeah, at the end of everything, we'd like get to take their shirts off. They get to do the pump work. They get to pose. We take pictures. Nice. And so what I did is, like, do you remember when you started lifting weights when you were like 13 or 14 and you were like, oh shit, my arm's bigger. And you're like checking it in the mirror.
Oh yeah.
I realized.
You get pumped up and you measure it.
Yeah.
That's the key.
Yeah. So I had to go back and remember what it was like to, you know, get a pump and to feel like that. And I was like, you know what, if I bring something fun where like, you know, cause when Shanji brought me Victor, he was real banged up. He had an L4, L5 issue, any form of axial loading shut him down. You know, he couldn't even tie his shoes the first day we started. And he asked me, he's like, where we start? I'm like, well, we're not going to train with shoes, so let's just get going. And over the course of like the last 2 years, I mean, I started working with him right after ADCC 2022. And this like 2 year cycle getting them ready. And then this Craig Jones thing hit and that kind of threw a monkey wrench, but it's still the same weekend, still the same people, still the same deal. But the one thing that was pretty amazing was, you know, we started just basically doing like Tabata sprints on the bike and trying to figure out what their max output and what they could really handle and what they couldn't. And it was pretty interesting when we started hitting them with that big lactate fucking burst, like the look on their faces was just unreal. and these are, you know, these are pros. This is what guys do for a living. And just how weak they were. And it's no fault of their own. They just had never been raised in a periodized strength conditioning. Like they didn't go to high school and lift weights and have some fucking crazy football coach pushing them through or, you know, any of the stuff I did in the NFL. So it was really fascinating to see guys that are at the top of their game that don't have any of these skills. And then when all of a sudden you add them in and now they got double body weight back squats, they can do 20 pull-ups, you know, they can hit 1900 on a 20-second sprint for max wattage on an echo bike. Now, all of a sudden, these guys are out there just fucking killing people because they're so much more physically strong than they were.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, I mean, I wouldn't say all of the combat athletes, but a lot of combat athletes, it's changed a bit now. Like, they didn't come up in team sport athletes. They didn't really come up as traditional sport athletes that had, like you said, an actual regimented strength conditioning program. They sure as hell didn't come up in a college setting or a pro team setting where they have all of it done for them. Like, they just kind of fell into combat sports because they weren't good at other sports. So you kind of have a lot of them, depends on the country, but a lot of them were just team sport guys that couldn't make the team or didn't want to be in a team. So they're just, you know, they're just kind of on their own and they got into combat sports one way or another. And a lot of them are just shitty athletes. Like Rich Franklin, when I first started talking to him, he was like, yeah, I never made varsity in my high school football team. Like I was just a shitty athlete. So I started boxing and wrestling and doing combat sports. And he, you know, at one point he was the world champion for a number of years. And the sport at the top, I think, in MMA at least has grown, but not necessarily in the rolling side of things. BJJ and some of the, well, wrestlers have more of a strength program, but BJJ in particular, a lot of those guys are just, you know, they never did anything. They just rolled.
So part of my theory with Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu is because the training is so awful and they don't really have a foundation or really like a centralized theme to work from, they're just taking steroids as a stopgap for shitty training. So I mean, yeah,
probably.
It's true.
Especially in South America.
Well, it's if you don't know how to train, and you're not really in a periodized intelligent strength conditioning program that's fostering developing athleticism and different planes of motion and all the shit they need to do, just take a bunch of drugs and go and do anything. I mean, I just read a pretty cool piece of research where they were given, I think they were untrained individuals, 600 milligrams of testosterone a week, and they actually gained more muscle than the people that took no testosterone that lifted weights for 8 weeks.
Trained.
Yeah. I mean, so like if you take enough drugs, like, and you eat and you know, you're doing something physical, isometrics and the pulling, I mean, something's going to happen from it, but it was pretty interesting, you know, just like one of the big factors I found for Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu is trunk stability and more importantly, rotation and, you know, that transverse plane in the hip mobility. If you're mobile in your hips, like you can do this thing and you can generate force in different positions. If you're stiff in your trunk, you're not going to get very far. So it's been really fascinating because, you know, I always, as an NFL player and then working with field sport athletes, I kind of always looked at the paradigm from standing. And now with jiu-jitsu, now it's like almost like a gyroscope, like a 360. These guys are on the ground doing the same position. So it's been really like an interesting thought process to see the deal. And then also I kind of figured if I was going to train or they're going to train with me, I should train with them. So I've been doing it now.
You start rolling.
Yeah. So I'm a blue belt. I'm not a very good blue belt, but I'm
it's fun though, isn't it? I mean, it's a totally different challenge and it's a humbling experience when you go against a high level black belt guy. I mean, I've had myself, my ass just completely handed to me so many times by these guys and they're smaller and they're weaker, but it doesn't matter at that point. They're so far ahead of me in skill level and technical ability that you're helpless. Like you feel literally helpless when you're rolling with some of those guys.
Yeah, no, that was me for the first year. And now as I'm like into the second year of this thing and, you know, I'm very fortunate to train with, you know, Victor 6'4", 260. And a lot of the guys that train in our place are big dudes. So there's definitely a style of little guy versus big guy jiu-jitsu and a lot of pressure and smash, and that's Shanji style. So it's been a lot of fun. And then I also basically adopted a bunch of Brazilians that I didn't think I needed. So now I got like a bunch of Brazilian kids that come and train with me every day, and it's been as meaningful for them as it is for me. But really prepping them this, and the Morpheus thing has been really interesting. Just be able to show them at which registers are different parts of the training, and then also yep. you know the idea, like I'm sure you'll get into, you know, the difference between, you know, high intensity interval training and really what people think it is and really isn't. Like, you know, how many people really and how long and how many minutes they really work into that high register. So before we get into it, I'd love to know how you got into this whole thing. Like, what got you down the road? And more importantly, like, how'd you get into training fighters and the HRV and all this? We interrupt this episode with a shameless self-promotion. Are you a field or court sport athlete looking to dominate the leaderboard? Let me introduce you to Field Strong. Take your inner athlete to the next level by exposing yourself to the advanced training techniques that contributed to my 10 years in the NFL. Unlock pinnacle performance and level up your athletic potential today. Head to powerathletehq.com/fieldstrong and claim your 7-day free trial. Now back to the show.
Yeah, I mean, so really it was kind of just some luck. Honestly, I opened a gym in 2003. I can back up before that. I worked at the University of Washington with a guy named Bill Gillespie. He was a monster power lifter, still in world class.
Yeah, yeah, I know Bill. He's one of the Sornix guys.
Yeah, Bill's been around forever. And so like the late 90s, I went down to the University of Washington weight room football program. I started interning with him. And then he went to the Seahawks. I followed him there for a year. And my whole game was just lift heavy shit as much as you possibly can. And my deadlift got better just spotting Bill on the bench, because the guy was benching back then like 600 or 700. Now he's done 800, 1,000. He did some insane numbers. But that was really my paradigm, was just lift a lot of really heavy weights. And that was the modality I thought in and was in football. And then I decided I really didn't want to go the NFL strength conditioning route because it's so unpredictable. You're playing musical chairs every few years, like your career is just wherever it takes you. I just didn't want to have that lifestyle, I guess. And so I decided I was going to open a gym. And I happened to open a gym next to a place called AMC Pancration. And for people who don't know what that is, it's a gym that still is the longest running MMA gym in the world. It was created in the 90s by Matt Hume and a guy named Haru out of Japan. And it's been MMA since the 90s. It wasn't like a boxing gym. It wasn't a BJJ gym. It was an MMA gym. So it's been there from the beginning. And Matt Hume, for anyone who's watched MMA for a long time, he's the wizard. He's, in my opinion, the greatest MMA coach of all time. He can not just teach every aspect of MMA, but he can do it all himself and will kick your ass and kick the ass of world champions in these different disciplines. Probably the best example of his is Josh Barnett and Demetrius Johnson. He took Demetrius Johnson, my high school wrestler, and made him one of the best of all time, from literally the ground up. But anyway, I decided to open my gym. I ended up opening up right next to these guys. It was not like I planned that out. At that point, MMA was a super underground sport. Like, people knew what MMA was, but it was very underground. Like, they had this cage mentality. Like, it was kind of this taboo. Like, you don't, you know, it's Fight Club. You don't talk about it. You might want to watch it, but it was not this big popular sport. And I was, you know, focusing on football. So I didn't plan this out. Like, I'm going to open a gym and it's going to turn into this huge sport. And it just kind of happened to be lucky. But I started working with those guys very early on. There was a guy, Ivan Salivary, walked over my gym. I think it was early 2004, maybe late 2003. And just asked if I could train for K1. And I was like, yeah, I can do that. And I had no idea what K1 was at the time. But I looked it up and started basically working with those guys, training with those guys, just diving all the way into it. And at the same time, about 3 or 4 years before that, I'd been introduced to heart rate variability by a Russian guy through another American named Randy Huntington, who's a super well-known track coach in the track field, but most people outside that haven't heard of him. He coached Mike Powell. He was the head of USA Track and Field Jumps. Great coach with Kaiser for a long time. But he introduced me to heart rate variability through the system called the Omega Wave. So, you know, very early on, back in 2003 and 4, I was able These to work are all with the, top-level world-class fighters and look at their HRV and look at their heart rates and just kind of, it was just a gigantic experiment to see what I could learn. And it was, you know, it shaped my career because of that, because it was so long ago.
Yeah, no, you're using a lot of names I know, like the Omega Wave. I remember seeing, God, what was that? Jay Schrader, the guy out of Arizona that was working
Arizona,
with Archuleta.
I was probably number 3 or 4 in the U.S. as a coach that had it. And the funny thing is, at the time it was $35,000, and I was like 23. I'm like, I don't have $35,000, but I have some connections into the industry if you guys want to work out a deal with me. And fortunately, the Russians are negotiators. And so I basically convinced him to let me make payments on it and help introduce it to other coaches around the U.S. I mean, I got Buddy Morris and Tom Myslinski and a bunch of Matt Nichols, a bunch of other people in the industry back then introduced to HRV pretty early on as well. By that point, like, no one knew what the hell it was. You'd be like, oh, lay down this table. I'm going to connect a bunch of electrodes to you. And then you're going to sit there for 2.5 minutes. And people are like, what the hell are you doing? Like, what is this thing? And so it was so far, you know, out there because cell phones were around, but there was no like fitness apps. There was no Fitbits. There was no wearables. Like there was heart rate straps and that was it. And so to tell people like, lay down this table, I'm going to measure you and talk about heart rate variability. It was hard to even explain what you were doing. So I had to search for the words and try different techniques to explain it to them in a way that would make sense. But it was super interesting because as soon as you start looking at this, you just realize how much people's lifestyle was playing a big factor. I'd see guys in Microsoft who were on a, you know, product deadline and they'd look trash, barely doing anything in the gym. I'd see two different fighters training the same program. One would look great the next day. One would look completely trash because their genetics and because they were heavyweights and because their lifestyle was shitty, who knows. But you just started to see how much individual variation there was and how people would respond to training. And you start to realize very quickly, like if I put 10 people in the exact same program, they're all going to get different results because they're all different people with different lifestyles, different genetics. And you just start to see this bigger picture of training that's not just sets and reps and exercises. It's all that plus their lifestyle, plus how their individual genetics and their fitness level and their training history. You just see this interaction of so many more things than you do if you just kind of have no way of measuring these things and looking at it.
This episode of Power Athlete Radio is powered by Train Heroic, the most immersive strength training app experience on the market. We've built an online training business by partnering with Train Heroic to deliver all of our world-class training programs like Jack Street, Hammer, Field Strong, and Grindstone. To learn which Power Athlete training program best suits your goals, head to powerathletehq.com/training. And if you're a coach looking to build a business with the best training tech in the business, head to trainheroic.com/powerathletehq. And now back to the show. No, I mean, it's pretty fascinating. I mean, as you get into the HRV, there's so many factors that continue to drive it, like diet. I mean, one of the bigger plays I've seen is sleep. For me, I could almost trick my HRV in if I went and did some aerobic work, like, you know, zone 1, zone 2, right on that cusp before bed. It tended to really fix it. And the more actually aerobic work I did, the better my HRV was, which is really hard pill to swallow because I was straight up in the Charlie Francis camp where it was either I was going to lift as heavy as I can, run as fast as I can, and figured that an aerobic base was NSAM bullshit and nobody fucking needed one. And it wasn't.
Yeah, I mean, trust me, I came from the same camp. I mean, you know, Bill's idea of aerobic work is walking to the, you know, to the car. Like, and as a power lifter, I get it. Like, that's the world you really do have to live in as a world-class power lifter. But when you start looking at the data, you start looking at what happens when you build aerobic system a bit and you start measuring the aerobic fitness of people you wouldn't think would have good aerobic fitness, you just realize it plays a much bigger role, not just in health, but performance. Like I looked at HRV and heart rate of like pole vaulters and high jumpers. And like, those are shot putters. Like you would think that these people would have very low aerobic system because they're generating just instantaneous power, but shit, they had resting heart rates in the low 50s, HRV in my system, at least in the 80s, like pretty high numbers from aerobic standpoint for someone who just runs down a track and jumps over a bar. You would think they wouldn't need it, but it's, yeah, when you take a step back, it's not just the event, it's the training for the event. The training is hundreds of repetitions. The training is recovering from a lot of volume of workouts, and you need that work capacity. If you don't have the aerobic side, your capacity to train as a whole and recover is diminished because it's the aerobic system that's doing everything in between the workouts. So it just, the more I looked at it, the more I worked with diverse populations and athletes across different spectrums, the more you realize it's a huge part of the game. You can't neglect it.
Is it necessarily a factor? Like one of our guys, Philippe Costa, he's like 24, not married, no kids, just professional athlete. He's consistently, even on his worst days, at 100, 101 on the Morpheus, like anywhere from like 101 to 106. So I got on the Facebook page. And I was like kind of asking and like, hey, is anybody seen HRVs this high? And of course, everybody was like, oh, yeah. And I'm like, but for the most part, I haven't seen anybody post.
Yeah, it's very, very rare. I mean, there's definitely a genetic component to HRV. I mean, I could train anything and everything all day long and I would never get close to 106. Like, I just don't have those genetics. And VO2 max we know is about 50% genetic, which is very tightly regulated to VO2 or to HRV, I mean. So yeah, I mean, you definitely get these freaks that just have crazy high HRVs. You also see people who barely train that have HRV that you would only expect to see on somebody who's a very well-conditioned athlete. So there's definitely a genetic component to it, and you kind of want the right range for the sport. But 102, 105, anything over 100 is very rare. I'd say we probably have less than, I don't know, 0.5% probably get up in that range. What's his resting heart rate? It's got to be super low.
Yeah, it's pretty low. I mean, I think so for me, I'm rated in like the low 50s, and those guys are probably in like the mid 40s, like lower 40s. So
yeah,
I
probably
think, yeah,
yeah, for 100, that's definitely got to be in that range. So yeah, it's super rare. It's genetic. You know, I'm sure his training is also good, but there's a genetic piece to it, like anything else.
yeah, and he eats about 600 grams of carbohydrates a day. And, you know, it's like I look at his diet and it's like, you know, rice and beans and like,
Oh yeah.
I'm like, God damn, dude, this dude eats more carbs in a day than I eat in a week. And,
Yeah, I mean, we had a guy, Mario Miranda, if anyone remembers Mario from the UFC. He was a Brazilian guy, and he would eat Skittles and candy and basically junk food all day long. But we took him to get DEXA tested, and he was like, I think it was like a 6.2 on DEXA. I remember Rich Franklin was rolling with him and kind of had his ear pressed up against Mario's chest. And he's like, "Hey, Mario, like that, your heart rate monitor is really hitting my ear." And Mario's like, "I don't have a heart rate monitor on." It was just his ab. He was just super lean, and he could. I'm not joking. He would run on a treadmill and be like 205, 210 heart rate and be talking to you. Like, just a super weird genetic freak. And HRV, same thing, super high. Like, you just kind of find these anomalies out there that have just super weird shit going on, and it's just how they're built.
Well, I mean, but that's pro sports. I mean, if you
Yeah,
look at,
totally, it's pro sports.
yeah, like if you look at the NFL, it's the land of genetic freaks.
It is.
It's just, you know, and no matter how much on Instagram people want to try to gamify it, say it's this and this, my comment to them is always, most of these guys, unless they got like hit by a bus when they were 10 years old, they were going to the NFL. You
Yeah,
know,
100%. I mean,
yeah.
that's the first thing you see when you start working with athletes. You're like, Jesus Christ, like these guys can just do anything. They can recover well. Their movement's incredible. They're explosive. I remember Kent Johnston, who was the strength coach I worked with, who's in the NFL for like 25 years. He was telling me the story of Reggie White. Reggie White had never done any sort of Olympic lifting. And Kent like introduced him to just basic, like showed him like a hang clean with like 135 or something, just introduced him to like how to do the very basics there in Green Bay. And so he leaves Reggie for a while. He goes and trains somebody else. He comes back. Reggie White's hang cleaning 405 for a triple. Like, just that powerful, explosive. Like, and he said his technique was really good. Like, you know, they're just freaks, as you know, as well as anybody. They're just genetic minority of the minority of the minority. And it's incredible to be around and watch. But people have this idea that's like perfect training, and they're just genetic freaks of nature, and some of them are successful despite their training or anything else.
No, that's it. They succeed in spite. It's yeah, it's been really fascinating working with these guys, just because you know, to be able to take an athlete that's already at a high level and have reached so much, but yet that we're so deficient in both strength and conditioning. And I heard John Danaher make an interesting comment that he's like, I've never seen a stronger, like a better prepared athlete in the weight room that follows the strength and conditioning program be better at jujitsu. And I was like, well, fuck, dude. Like that's such a dumb statement. But I mean, he's just making an observation. Whereas for the guys that I work with, it's almost as if once they become stronger, once they became more confident, I mean, they added all these pieces. These guys just took off. I mean, and the conditioning component was so important. Like, just,
Yeah, I mean, the hard part, I mean, it's getting better now, but traditionally, like, you'd have these combat athletes that'd be going, like, MMA in particular, they'd be going to, like, their BJJ coach, they'd go to their striking coach, they'd go to maybe a wrestling coach, and then they'd go to a strength and conditioning coach. And you just kind of had all this jumbled mess thrown together in their program, and some of it worked out, but a lot of them would just burn themselves out, and they'd make great progress for a couple years, and then they would just start having injury after injury because they were just getting too much from too many people thrown on there. But if you take a guy that's got a good regimented BJJ program and you throw in a really good strength conditioning program, it's all monitored, managed well, like you can turn them into a beast because they're competing with other guys who aren't in that program,
Yeah,
don't have that athleticism.
no, it's been fascinating too. And then also adding that component of athleticism from the gym, like being able to jump over things, and you know, especially with some of the density training we do with like sandbags, swinging kettlebells, and just some, you know, heavy hard grip, like old fashioned strongman time stuff, has been a really interesting place for them to go and see that in the training. So it's been a lot of fun. But yeah, hopefully the culmination of this 2 year long tests that I've been doing and the program and everything I designed for it. Like, I'm kind of excited to see the culmination of this 2 years. And like, God, I hope they go out and fucking win. I'm like,
it's, I mean, you know, you came from a team sports background. I came from team sports background. It's a very, very different thing as a coach to go out and watch a team that you're working with play. I mean, it's obviously intense and you're into the game, but when you've got one person you've spent 2 years with or 4 years with, and they're in there a match, and that match is everything. That one match is a world title, or it's, you know, a chance to get to the world title. It is intense. Like, there's nothing, I don't think, at least my coaching, like this one-on-one match, especially if it's, you know, a big event like this, or it's on TV. Like, it is so intense to watch as a coach, because you're sitting there and like all the work, you know, how many hours they put into it, you know, how many hours you've put into it. And this one match is everything. I mean, they could make one stupid mistake, they can get caught, they can get knocked out, or they can get submitted. Like, there's just, it's such a sport where like anything can literally happen. There are no guarantees, and you just sit there and, you know, you put the work in, done what you can do, but my God, it's super intense. So I don't know if you've been part of this big level, you know, prepare one guy for 2 years or not yet, but if this is your first time, it's going to be a ride.
Yeah, no, Victor did pretty well. He won Brazilian Nationals double gold, and then he came in and won Worlds double gold last year. And awesome. Then he's won a series of like these Who's Number One, but also the Fight Pass deals. So we've been going out to Vegas a bunch for these Fight Passes. So he's he's been pretty well, but like something of this magnitude, I mean, you know, for the ADCC, I mean, that's their Olympics. And then all of a sudden, you know, Craig Jones comes in and fucking upstages them with, you know, some investor to drop a couple $1 million. And so there's two 16-man brackets. Winner takes $1 million for a 26-year-old Brazilian kid from Florida Leza to be able to come in and put $1 million in your pocket. Like, that's some life-changing shit.
That's totally life-changing event. I mean, so we don't need to get too many stories, but Matt Hume, the guy I worked with, just from context for everybody, Matt Hume worked with the Prince of Abu Dhabi to create Abu Dhabi Combat Club. Mm. Matt was basically flown over there way back when. It's a crazy story, but this guy called up and wanted to order some of Matt's pancreation wrestling BJ. They weren't BJJ. Matt does pancreas. Anyway, this guy calls up, wants to order some of Matt's VHS tapes on fighting, basically. And he wants to like send a check. And they're like, well, we'll send you the cassettes when the check clears. And then somehow they find out it's like related to someone in Abu Dhabi. It's like a prince. Like, never mind, we'll send you whatever you want right now. And so they send him over all these tapes, and sure enough, a few weeks later, they want to bring Matt over to Abu Dhabi to work with the Prince of Abu Dhabi, who's interested in grappling, basically. And so Matt trains him, lived over there for a while. Henzo Gracie was also his coach at one point, and they essentially tells Matt, like, I want to turn this big horse stable into a combat club. I want to create something that's never been done before. And Matt's like, okay. And they have this like horse stable, like a $4 million chandelier, like just crazy stuff in the Middle East, and essentially like creates Abu Dhabi Combat Club with Matt kind of serving as the advisor to do the whole thing. And funny story is he wants to create this like food hall and wants to make it authentic to Japan. And so he asked Matt, like, what's authentic Japanese food that people would eat? And Matt's like, chanko is like in the sumo halls. It's like soup, basically different varieties of soup. And so he like brings someone over from Japan. He like tries to make it. Matt's like, that's not quite Japanese level. And so he like fires that guy, brings another guy. And Matt's like, this guy's better. This is really close to what we expect, but not quite right. And he comes back another time and he's like, how's this? And Matt's like, ooh, that's amazing. And he had like $10,000 Kobe Wagyu beef soup, basically. And the prince just like, the amount of money that got put into building Abu Dhabi Combat Club is just mind-boggling. I mean, nobody else was going to do that, but Sheikh Taknoon was the guy's name, the Prince of Abu Dhabi. So yeah, I mean, literally that whole thing exists just because Sheikh Taknoon was interested in combat sports. Like, that's it. It's just one guy with more money than you could ever know what to do with, deciding he likes combat sports, likes grappling, and he created Abu Dhabi Combat Club as like his own little plaything, basically, as a way to, you know, build a sport, which is pretty crazy. But here we are, you know, two decades plus later, and here it is.
Yeah, no, it's I didn't know shit about this stuff. Honestly, it didn't even pop into my radar until I got introduced. You know, we work a lot of work with Naval Special Warfare. And I was at a training thing. There was a retired SEAL guy that was one of Shanji's black belts. It was like, hey, the guy that I trained with who gave me my black belt lives in Austin, connected us. And then that's when I went over and started kind of checking it out a little bit. And I just thought jiu-jitsu was kind of dumb from what I'd seen before. It just looked like a bunch of dudes laying on the ground trying to choke each other.
Yeah.
So
outside is what it looks like.
Yeah. So it just, it didn't really appeal to me. And then I started taking my daughter. And then that's when Shanji hit me up. He's like, hey, I got some young guys that'd be great if you could help me with. And I was like, yeah, bring them by. Meet other professional athletes. So in my head, I'm thinking, oh, they're like the, you know, the pros that I work with. And then when they came in, I was like, you're telling me these guys have worked out, that these guys are professionals and that they're really good? He's like, yeah, they're some of the best in the world. And I was like, I saw this gap. And I, at that point, I was like, man, we can cover a lot of distance really quickly. I just need consistency and don't ask me any fucking questions. And they were like, we're in. Yeah. So yeah. It's
the tough part is getting the resilience to show up on time. I don't know if you saw that one. Resilience do not want to show up on time. Like they just don't. Like, oh, yeah, I'll be there. I'll be there. Like, no, they won't. They'll be late. And it's just.
It's.
South Americans in general, Brazilians in particular, they're late. Like, that's just. How it is. We went to this training camp with Rich Franklin and Anderson Silva way back in the day when Rich is preparing for Vanderlei, and you couldn't have more opposite approaches. Rich Franklin was a math teacher. He's like punctual to the minute, like wants to know what each workout's going to be, wants to know what every rep's going to be, wants to know what weight's going to be in the bar. He wants to know the rest. Like he wants to know everything and like has to be on time. And like we'd be training and Anderson Silva would show up like 2 hours late, 2.5 hours late, like at the end of practice. And that's just like, the Brazilian mentality. They show up when they show up. So if you've solved that one, you've really done something.
I found it through shame and punishment. there's like a 15-minute buffer that we have. Like if the training starts at 2, like the latest you can show up at 2:15. If you show up at 2:16, you're either going to get punished or you just got to leave. So we're real good of like doing it. And then there's a lot of humiliation. And I don't mean like humiliation in a bad way, but like I have there was a snap that I took from an article where they talked about punctuality as a form of racism and more importantly, like white supremacy. So I'll send them that and just kind of make a lot of jokes about it where it's like, right. Hey, dude, like I know this is a cultural thing for you, but I got a very small window of time to work with you guys. And, you know, like when I hit the clock, like if it gets over 75 minutes, like I'm like, we're done. Like just because they roll anywhere from 2 to 3 times a day, 6-7 days a week. They train with me 3 days. And then it's like the amount of sessions that they do. I mean, on some weeks it's approaching 18-21 sessions. And I'm like, dude,
crazy.
Yeah. I mean, they roll at 6:30 in the morning. They roll in their comp class and they roll at night. They come train with me. And so it's a full-time job. And, you know, the problem is if all of a sudden that workout starts creeping into like 70, 80, 90 minutes, like the intensity falls off too much. And I'm like, dude, I'm not a, you know, junk volume type of guy. So there's like a certain amount of work and there's an intensity and a number and everything's got to be hit. And if it's not, then we're just going to cut it. And you guys aren't ready to do it that day. So,
yeah, I mean, if you got them show them in 15-minute window, you've got the Brazilians down because for a Brazilian, like 20 minutes late is super on time. So 15 minutes late is like a record setter for those guys. That's pretty funny.
Yeah, that's in the beginning, it was like that. And then all of a sudden, I think they saw me get real fucking pissed. Because in the NFL, if you're not 5 or 10 minutes early, you're already fucking late. So that's like a big thing for me just because I got a small window. And I'm like, hey, dude, if you were paying me some exorbitant amount of money, then you can fuck around my time. But like for this, I think they're young enough to where hopefully I can like instill a little bit of punctuality with them. Because, I mean, they also own gyms and train kids. And the last thing you're going to do if you're showing up paying a couple $100 for your kid to do jiu-jitsu and the instructor shows up fucking 30 minutes late, like that doesn't
go. I was wondering how that works in like Brazilian gyms. Like they have class times or they just not going to have show up when you want? Because in Brazil, like they're very punctual as a whole.
I don't know how it works in Brazil. I think they just probably drop their kids off or maybe their kids walk. But like, you know, where we are in Austin, you know, people are professionals and they got, you know, if the class is 4:30, they're going to make sure the kids are there. And I think the guys have really, you know, because I think that's the one thing that kind of separates Victor and the guys I've been training is that they still coach classes and they still train kids. So they can't go full Gordon Ryan and, you know, fucking, you know, talk about how great you are all the time and all the drugs that you take and all this other bullshit when you're in there training 5 and 6 year olds. And that's why I've always said, I'm like, you guys are, you know, like good dudes. But at the end of the day, when you get on the mat, like we don't need to be good fucking people. You got to go out there and murder people. So hopefully hopefully I can give them a little bit of that NFL mentality where you're out there playing for blood. I mean, this isn't friendly.
Like they're laid back. They're late. They don't usually have that fire. And honestly, there's been some guys that we've worked with and the Brazilians and the South Americans. Like they just, that was kind of Achilles heels. Like they wouldn't go for the finish. They wouldn't go for the opportunity. Like they just didn't have that mindset they needed to be a finisher. And that's the hard part is, you know, you can work on it, but it's hard to get some of those guys to make that transition of, no, like your job is to attack and finish as soon as the opportunity comes, you've got to go 100%. You have to go for it. And they just, I just wouldn't.
Well, the these guys are also mentored by Shanji Ribeiro and Salo Ribeiro. And if you know Salo, I've never met him, but the story is he's a fucking psychopath. And Shanji's pretty far along the lines of that, too. So those guys are intense dudes, and they fucking bring it. So I think that the fact that they've been mentored by two guys that are pretty serious, like, I think that's important. Because at the end of the day, like, you end up kind of evolving into who mentors you. I mean, the age old, everybody becomes their parents. Like, whoever kind of mentors you is really, you know, and I don't know if that gets enough publicity, especially in the fight game. You know, I mean, it did with Mike Tyson. I mean, if you look at Customato. I mean, and I sometimes wonder in the UFC and the fight game if there's not enough emphasis put on like who mentors and who coaches these guys, because you rarely ever see anything about it.
It's interesting. I mean, it used to be like kind of had a few camps. You had like Pat Miletich and you had Matt Hume and you had a few kind of small camps in MMA. And now it's just guys from coming from all over the place. I don't think there's nearly as much structure in the camps you go to that are as organized and have the top leaders and the top guys like Matt and Pat and a bunch of other guys. So you get some camps that are really well structured and have good leadership and good guys in it, and you get other camps that are total shit that just don't have it, and guys are kind of on their own. Like, it's a crapshoot. I mean, same thing in Brazil. I mean, you used to have Shoot a Box, and I went down there and watched those guys train, and they were as intense as anybody. They were, you had Vanderlei Silva in there beating the hell out of everybody, and you had just the top guys all at Shoot a Box or Brazilian Top Team, and you had these really well-known MMA groups down there that were very well trained and beat the hell out of each other and just built each other into what they were. And now I think that's kind of splintered a bit, and you have way more camps. So yeah, I don't know. It's, if I was coming up as a combat athlete, like, you'd have to find the right camp. If you can't find the right group of coaches, the right guys to be around, like, it's gonna be so hard to be successful in that sport.
Well, especially too with the UFC, it feels like it's evolved. You know, early on you see UFC 1 and you see, you know, Horace Gracie go out and fucking submit everybody in the gi. And now all of a sudden, you know, if you look at like the prevalence of like high level wrestlers, like the kind of like the Bo Nichols, for example, and then like a mix of like high level wrestling mixed with some Muay Thai and, you know, enough jiu-jitsu defense to not get caught in an arm bar and, you know, have to, if you got to finish somebody. So it's pretty interesting to see like the evolution, you know, because usually like the wrestlers are usually hard nose and fucking high intensity and go, 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 go on that attacking. So it's been really interesting to see the evolution of the USC or the UFC and like, you know, like kind of like what their kind of perfect blend of athlete is.
Yeah, no, it's changed. I mean, it's definitely changed since the beginning, but it's even changed since I started training those guys in 2003, 2004. I mean, back then you could have one or two weaknesses, but if you were really good at something, you could go a really long way. I mean, you could die. If you were a great wrestler that you could just take people down and ground and pound, you could get away with that. If you were a terrible striker, you had no submission game, you would just be able to use your wrestling to your advantage and mow through a lot of people. And then you had guys that were great strikers, and as long as it had sort of decent takedown defense, they would beat everybody. But it got to the point where if you had a glaring weakness, you were going to get caught, and you just couldn't be good without being pretty well-rounded. But now it's like you're well-rounded and you're really good at something that you can leverage really well. So it's definitely evolved significantly, and the level of athleticism's evolved significantly. The athletes back in the day of, you know, 2004 and 5, a lot of them weren't great athletes at all. Now they're all pretty good athletes, and the top athletes, the top in the sport, are amazing athletes. And, you know, Demetrius Johnson, I worked with, is an amazing athlete, fast as hell, extremely well conditioned, great sense of movement, great awareness, very smart in the ring, like had all the pieces that it took to be successful. That's why he set the record for title defenses. But you saw the level of athleticism grow up, you saw the level of well-roundedness go up, you saw the level of skill go up, and, you know, that's where sport's going to have to go if it's going to evolve, and it has.
All right. So as much as I love talking about this, I got a ton of questions I want to ask you. I figure I'd get you on and hit you with this. I want to get your take on concurrent training. You were kind of ahead of the curve early on taking like the training in this direction. I mean, if you look at like, you know, the early stuff, and I even saw that in 2009 when we were going out working with CrossFit, there was still this prevalence towards like, you know, build an aerobic base and then kind of build into the pyramid. But you looked at it like, you know, you can continue to gain muscle, you know, and the old adage of like cardio will kill your gains has been something that, you know, you basically have disproved. So I wanted to get in on your take on the concurrent training and really how that's evolved.
Yeah, I mean, particularly working in combat sports, I mean, you can't just not train one aspect of it. You have to train everything. And a lot of it comes down to prioritization. I mean, like you said, people have this idea that you train slow, you're going to be slow. And if you do any sort of cardio, you're going to lose all your muscle and strength. But the reality is combat sports and many sports are so aerobically driven that you can't just not develop the aerobic system. You can't not do some form of cardiovascular work. And so to me, it comes down to, like anything else, it's where is this athlete's weak point? I'm going to attack that. I'm going to at least maintain the other areas. So everything gets trained together. It's just the proportional amounts and how much emphasis I'm putting on one side versus another. It's as simple as I evaluate somebody, he's weak as shit, his movement's bad, et cetera. I'm going to focus on that, and I'm going to maintain the aerobic piece through his normal training and lower volumes. If it's the opposite, I see that his aerobic conditioning is terrible, but he's already reasonably strong, then I'm going to focus on that area where he needs to develop the most and to maintain the other area. So you're always training concurrently. You're always training every element for the most part. It's just which area do you really focus on trying to improve, because you're not going to improve all of them at once, because you can't train enough in one area to train all of them in a way that they're all going to improve. So it's just prioritization as much as anything else. I don't think you need to go through this, like, there's always this linear, like, you do this, then you do this, then you do this. Well, what if that's not what that person needs? What if that's not the path that person is going to progress under? So to me, it's just evaluating very effectively what someone's really good at, what they're lacking, what their limitations are, what's holding them back, and then building their program around getting rid of those weaknesses so they can maximize their strengths, whatever that looks like. It really is kind of that simple, the high level.
So how do you target that? Like, how do you set up, or, you know, I know you use Morpheus, but like finding like max heart rates, like what's the testing that you use when your athletes come in? Is there any baselines that you use to kind of help you figure that? Or is it something that you kind of develop as you start working with them and seeing kind of where they're deficient?
Yeah. I mean, so kind of my baseline story is the combat guys, I saw how weak they were and I said, okay, we can start developing a ton of strength. But then when I rolled with them, I realized that, you know, they didn't need to lift like a power lifter per se, because their strength is applied very differently. So I've always just, when I start working a new sport, I try to answer one question. It's what separates the really good people at the top of the sport from the people who are shittier or lower level of sport? Not just skill. Skill's always the differentiator, right? At the end of the day, sports are skill. But what separates them from a physical standpoint? What makes the people the best physically better than the people at the lowest end? And so I try to collect as much testing data as I can. We'll look at measures of aerobic fitness. We'll look at measures of anaerobic fitness and lactate threshold and power output and mobility. And you start to kind of build this picture of like, okay, I see now, once you have enough people kind of go through your assessment of, here's what makes a really good combat athlete tick, or here's what makes a really good BJJ guy a good BJJ guy from an athletic standpoint. And once you have that model and you kind of understand what are the markers that someone needs to be able to get to be successful in that sport, then you can evaluate everybody against that and figure out where they are deficient. And so when I first started working combat athletes, I tested everything. I tested probably way too many things, a bunch of jump metrics, a bunch of like 20, you know, shuttles and ground reaction time and push-ups and pull-ups and bench and squat and deadlift and anything I could think of, I was evaluating. And then when I start to see variables that like, oh, all the really good guys are pretty good at this, and all the guys that are shitty are bad at this, it gave me this blueprint, like I said, of, okay, here's where we need to be thinking about developing physiological traits towards, because this is what the best guys can do. And, you know, I started working with another good example of an obscure sport is ultimate frisbee, which people probably laugh at and think it's not a sport, but ultimate frisbee athletes are very good athletes, surprisingly. And so I started measuring, I had this team who came in from Seattle that was like a world champion or world class level ultimate frisbee team. And I'm like, what the hell makes a good ultimate frisbee player? I have no idea. And so I started training a bunch of testing sprint times and reaction times and vertical jump times and measures aerobic capacity and strength numbers. And again, when you do that, patterns emerge and you just kind of see there are certain qualities you have to have if you want to get to a really good level at a particular sport. And that gives you a blueprint, because you can then just compare everyone and see where are you at relative to these things. I mean, it's no different than the NFL. And the combine is there for a reason. It's not going to predict performance necessarily, but at least gives the coaching staff some idea of the likelihood of what someone's going to do when they get in the NFL, because they don't have these qualities. They know they're less likely to be successful. And so that's kind of the approach I took, is I would start working the sport. I'd try to collect as much data as I could. And then I'd just try to figure out what were the most important variables, what are the most important things to have as an athlete. And then I would train towards those. It really, you know, the more you work the individuals, the more you work the sport, the more that stuff becomes obvious and second nature. But I just kind of took the path of test everything and see what becomes important as you work with them.
How important is VO2 max?
Depends on the sport, but I would say it's important for like up to a point. So there's always a point where more VO2 is probably not going to lead to more performance, but there's also a point where too low VO2 max is always going to be a limiting factor. And where those two thresholds are really depends on the sport, because aerobic power output is hugely important for endurance and maintaining your strength output over given lengths of time. But how much time you have to maintain it for dictates a lot of how high you really need to get it. It's important for recovery. It's important for a lot of things. But each sport, I would just say each sport has kind of a sweet spot of you need to be above this number. Otherwise, you're going to be deficient. And if you keep go above this number, it's probably not more beneficial. And it might take so much training time to get above that point that it's going to waste your time. So you got to kind of, again, find this sweet spot of ranges that are necessary if you're given sport. And if you're not measuring VO2, you can kind of just look at resting heart rate as a surrogate or look at various other parameters. But it's aerobic system in general is very important for most sports because most sports have a huge aerobic component, whether people realize it or not, whether it's the skill itself or the recovery between bouts of the skill, the aerobic system drives that. But it doesn't mean that you need a VO2 max of a marathon runner to play football or to be a grappler. You don't. And trying to get it to a 90 or 80 or whatever is not going to make you a better combat athlete. But if your VO2 max is in the 40s, then you're going to have some serious problems. So it really depends on, you know, again, what sport are we talking about? What level of fitness are we trying to get to with the sport? You know, you just, again, as you test athletes, you kind of find where most athletes fall in these different sports. And then you kind of realize, okay, most people are somewhere, let's say at a 50 to a 60 in the sport. And that's probably where they need to be. They're deficient. We build it. They're too high. You know, you're wasting time.
Yeah. We've really found developing an aerobic base has paid massive dividends in the recovery in between sets. So we, you know, like not only are we testing bar speed, using compensatory acceleration in plyos, the ability to be able to generate force and that like rate of force development with shorter rest periods, like let's say 90 to 120 seconds, it's pretty interesting. As all of a sudden, like, you know, we'll do like recovery rides, for example, like I need to do like zone one, zone two. And it's pretty interesting to kind of track calories and how much effort they're putting and like, you know, at the sim heart rate. Like I'll use like a sub 140, like I want to stay below 140 beats and then see how long they can kind of stay there. And it's really like 20, 25 minutes. And then looking at the calories and then all of a sudden they get in and I can see, you know, like all of a sudden something goes hard and then how fast they're able to recover. So it's been really interesting just that like recovery. And I don't know if it gets enough where people think like, oh, you know, fucking zone two, boring cardio, fucking body fat and all this. And I'm like, no, no, no. Uh-huh. It's about recovering in between so that we can have maximal efforts and be able to do more repeated effort attempts.
Yeah, exactly. And there's a really simple reason for that. So when you're producing max force and power, your fast twitch muscle fibers are obviously doing the majority of that force and power work. And they're utilizing stored ATP and they're using phosphocreatine, which we know from supplementation, to produce more ATP. And though it's a very short, high energy system, but it's very short lived, right? It's, you know, 6, 8, 10, 12 seconds and it starts to go bad quickly. It starts to run out of phosphocreatine, your stored ATP, and now you have to get into the lactic system. But anyway, the only way that that body can regenerate those stored phosphocreatine components that you can then utilize again is with the aerobic system. So the aerobic system is involved in restocking, refueling, however you want to look at it, the ability to be explosive again. So higher level of aerobic fitness means that you can resynthesize phosphocreatine faster and more efficiently so that you can then be explosive again. Now, again, there are upper limits. There, you can't just triple it or quadruple it by increasing your VO2 to a crazy level. But if you don't have that capacity, if you don't have the aerobic system's capacity to regenerate ATP as quickly, then it takes you much longer before you can become explosive again. And there's other components to it, but the aerobic system sets the limit on how quickly you can recover from anaerobic events. And people often don't realize that.
You know, there's a lot of talk of energy systems and you brought up like ATP and we talked about zone one, zone two. Like how do these different energy systems play into like an athlete? Like you think about like, you know, the majority of the work they're going to probably do. And I always think about everything in context of football, but it's like 5 to 7 seconds. You're probably working at some like, you know, max intensity of, you know, 90, 95%, 100% effort. And then all of a sudden you get up and you got anywhere from 30 to 45, 60 seconds to recover. And you might do that 3 times in a row. You might do it 18 times in a row. So it's kind of like high and then low, high and low. But for most people that are going to the gym or let's say that are training or doing different sports, it's not very indicative. So as we get into these different energy systems, like how do they kind of balance this whole thing to try to figure out like what is the most beneficial place to train?
Yeah, I mean, again, if someone's goal is like, I want to live a long, healthy life, I think we have pretty clear research now that shows us VO2 max and aerobic fitness is a hugely important piece of that. And then you need enough strength to move around. You don't want to lose muscle mass as you age. You want to slow that process down. You don't want to fall and break a hip as you get older. You want enough strength and muscle mass, which is the anaerobic piece, to do the things that you enjoy doing in your life. And that's a very different model of performance than somebody who wants to play football or grapple or whatever. They're going to have to produce much higher rates of force and power on a daily basis than somebody who's just living their life and wants to go out and, you know, do the things they do, go for bike rides, go for hikes, whatever. So the average human being has a very different energy demand than somebody who is an athlete. And so again, you want to look at what are the pieces that drive that. Our body is meant to produce as much force and power as it can aerobically, and then whatever it can't produce, then it has to make it up anaerobically. So if I can produce, just to make up a number, I don't know, 400 watts aerobically, and I ask my body to produce 600 watts, well, it has to make that up anaerobically. It has to make up 200 watts anaerobically. It's called the anaerobic power reserve or speed reserve. And the more you tap into the anaerobic side, the faster you're going to fatigue. That's just how the body is built. It's not meant to produce high levels of anaerobic power for minutes on end. It can't do it. That's why football is a short event. It's max power, but it's 6 seconds, 8 seconds. Yeah. It's not max power for 5 minutes. It's seconds. And so you just have to look at what are the demands that you're trained for if you're an athlete, and then you can figure out, okay, there's 6 seconds. That's obviously very highly anaerobic. And then that recovery period is entirely aerobic. And that's what's going to drive their ability to do that over and over again. For your average human being, again, I would say you want to basically develop VO2 max to really the highest you can to some extent. And then you want enough strength and muscle mass to be active, to support your lifestyle, to do the things that you want to do, to be metabolically healthy, to have good bone density, and all those things as you age. So this is a whole other topic, but when we look at research for longevity, we see that somewhere around 2 to 3 sessions a week of strength training seems to be the sweet spot for the average human being. So probably 2 to 3 days, what we'd call, you know, anaerobic lifting, some form of maybe anaerobic sprinting or some form of anaerobic, about 2 to 3 days a week is where we see people associated with the longest longevity. And we start seeing people doing 4, 5, 6 sessions of strength training a week. In some papers, their longevity starts going the other direction. This isn't causative. We can't show that like 6 days a week strength training is bad for you. It probably isn't, depending on the person. But we see that most people need to spend probably 2 or 3 days a week lifting weights and doing some form of strength training at most. And then the rest of the time should be that aerobic work. Zone 2, zone 1, maybe some higher intensity intervals, but spend the rest of the time doing those sort of things to build the VO2 max and the aerobic system as high as you can. So that's, you know, a very different picture than an athlete who's having to be explosive all the time and having to work anaerobically at a very high percentage. So you just have to, again, look at what someone's goals are to figure out what energy systems need to be targeting. But your average human being who just wants to live a long life, you need a high VO2 and enough muscle mass and strength to do the things you want to do and not lose muscle mass or decrease it and, you know, not break a hip as you get older. And if you're an athlete, you've got to develop whatever qualities and percentages you need to be successful.
How long does it take to develop an aerobic system? I mean, if somebody is, you know, lifting weights and really kind of like, let's say they bought into like, let's say CrossFit, for example, and I'm just going to go and do, you know, 5 to 7, 10 minute these burners, you know, and then, you know, the only aerobic work I'm doing really looks like just walking to my car to the gym. If somebody's already, you know, fairly fit or at least, you know, decently muscled, if they wanted to develop that aerobic system, like what kind of time frame are they looking at?
I mean, the good thing about the aerobic system is it's very adaptable, and we can look at it in two pieces. We can look at the muscles themselves, the tissues themselves, the cells and their ability to draw in oxygen. So that's one piece, and that's where mitochondria come in and enzymes and different pieces come in. That can be developed pretty quickly because it changes very quickly. We can increase our mitochondria very quickly. We can increase their functional capacity pretty quickly. Those things are fairly quickly developed. Then we have this centralized piece, and this is the heart itself, how the heart is formed, how the blood vessels and the network of capillaries, all these things go out throughout the body. That's the slow piece. That takes higher volumes and much longer periods of time. Well, the mitochondria can too, but I would say it really depends on where you're starting from, but you can see noticeable improvements if you're starting out very quickly. It's like anything else. You never lift weights, you can make quick progress. So someone who's never done anything aerobically, I mean, they can see 4, 5, 6 point increases in VO2 max within, you know, a few months a lot of times. If you're talking about somebody who's been training aerobically for years and they're trying to get from a VO2 of like 60 to 65, that could take months to years. There's also, like I said, a really big genetic piece to it. So it's like anything else. If you're genetically inclined to be good at it, you can make pretty fast progress, particularly if you're starting out from a low point. If you're a genetic, they call them aerobic non-responders. If you're an aerobic non-responder and you've just lifted weights your entire life, it's going to be a slow process. You're going to have to put in, you know, weeks to months to see big measurable increases. But either way, aerobic system can be improved. It's just a question of time. I think the problem is people don't like to put in the time, and the aerobic system's not like lifting weights where you can do it 2 or 3 times a week and make strength progress pretty consistently if you're, you know, smart about it. The aerobic system needs to be trained more frequently. It needs to be trained 3, 4, 5, realistically 4 to 6 days a week in some capacity if you're going to make real sustained long-term progress towards a high level of it. You can't just get away with 2 sessions of high intensity and call it good. That'll get you somewhere. If you're starting out from zero, it'll help, but you'll get stuck pretty quickly. You just need more frequency in the aerobic system just based on how it's built.
Yeah, the when I use the Morpheus, it usually is around, like, I think the green, which can be anywhere from like 90 to 140, which is really the volume of the training. I think I'm always around like 117, 124 minutes, somewhere in there a week. So for me, it's like either 5:30, no, what is it, like 5 25-minute sessions or 6 20-minute sessions, however it is. But I never really start counting until until you hit your target heart rate. So it's like, and I can always tell my aerobic fitness by how long it takes me to ride to get to my certain heart rate. Like if it takes me, you know, like 10 minutes of just kind of like going, or I got to burn it down for the first 6 or 7 minutes to try to get my heart rate up, that's usually a good indicator that I'm becoming like more aerobically fit, that it's taken me longer to get up there. And then I got to put more effort to kind of keep it there. Cause you know, when you first start, it's pretty easy to get your heart rate up and you just can kind of ride and keep it up. And next thing you know, you're fine. And then all of a sudden you're like, fuck, dude, I'm riding like a demon. I'm at like 115 beats a minute. So
it's just how much, I mean, that's what fitness is in a lot of ways. It's how much, what's the metabolic cost to produce a given level of power? It kind of comes down to that in a lot of ways. The more aerobically fit you are, you're able to generate more power at lower heart rates because your body's more efficient. It's able to create, I don't know, like I said, 600 watts of power instead of 200 watts of power for the same metabolic cost. The same underlying physiological process is the same aerobic output is creating much higher power output. That's what you can do with your aerobic system. So like you said, when you're riding or you're doing something, you see like, oh, my heart rate's only 115, but I'm producing all this power. That is aerobic fitness. It means you can sustain that power much longer than if you were, you know, had to go at a much higher heart rate to generate that speed or that power. And that's a really good thing about the aerobic system is you can measure it pretty easily if you're paying attention to these things. I think that's part of the challenge with things is people know if they're getting stronger in the weight room because the weight goes up. Or it doesn't, right? Like, you know, if you're getting stronger in the deadlift because you're deadlifting more weight or doing more reps. But if you're not measuring heart rate and you're not paying attention, like you can be like, oh, I feel better, but you don't really know whether or not you're improving unless you're looking at something like heart rate and you're paying attention to some sort of speed or you're looking at your heart rate coming down between reps. And I think that's something people need to be aware of. If you're going to improve something, you have to have some way to know whether or not it's improving, because how else do you know if the program's working? So that's where, you know, whether you're using Morpheus or any other heart rate monitor, that's one of the biggest values a heart rate monitor has, is you can get this gauge of, am I actually getting better? Am I being able to put out more power output at lower heart rates? Is my heart rate coming down faster between repetitions of intervals? Is my resting heart rate coming down or my HRV going up? Those sorts of things are the best indicators of, yeah, you're doing a good job, keep it up. Or for some reason, you're not getting better and you got to figure out why you're not doing enough. Are you doing too much? What's the thing that's not leading to results? But you have to use a heart rate monitor if you really want to dial in the aerobic system. It's just too hard to have all guesswork and subjective feelings if you're not looking at any objective numbers at all.
I know the Morpheus is a chest strap, which everything I've read is by far the most accurate. But what about like the, I don't know, Apple Watches or the Polar, you know, Garmin, or even some of the Ring stuff? Like, what about the collection on those?
I mean, so it's steady state. So like, let's say I'm just going to go for a light jog or zone 2 run or whatever. It's steady state type activities. Armbands, wristbands tend to be pretty accurate. Where they become much less accurate is when you're doing high intensity stuff, when you're changing direction, when you're doing things where your arms are moving around very rapidly, because they're working off like basically shooting light into your skin and measuring how much comes back. If there's a lot of movement around your wrist, those things become very inaccurate on those types of activities. So it's much harder to use those, you know, in a sport performance or when you're doing high intensity intervals or when you're just doing anything where it's rapid change of direction. Those intervals, those heart rates are going to be much less accurate with a wrist-based sensor, an optical sensor of any kind, just because your wrist is moving around a lot. You create what's called motion artifacts. So I would say if you're going to go out and just do like a light run or a cycle or something kind of steady, somewhat, you know, in cadence, then they can be pretty accurate most of the time. If you're doing anything else, it's going to be a crapshoot. Some of them are better than others. The Apple Watch seems to be the best because they've created an algorithm that looks tries to find when the data looks unstable or looks shitty and just kind of seems to discard it and ignore it and kind of interpolate it and kind of guess, which seems to be better than some of the other ones. Whoop is, seems to be the least accurate in my experience. Garmin is pretty good. They've you know, these are the companies that have billions of dollars or at least hundreds of millions of dollars to invest in trying to make them better. And the, you know, the best companies are probably doing a better job than the worst companies, but I still wouldn't recommend using a wrist-based sensor for something that's very high intensity and very fast paced and change. Like, you just, you're just not getting great numbers. You're not getting great resolution. It might show you at 160 when you're really at 140 or vice versa. And those numbers matter. So it just depends on what you're doing, really.
Yeah, no, I've been, I've worn the chest strap for Jits, and in the gi, it's a little bit more difficult to keep it in place just because I think like the cloth and like the rubbing and especially that, but like, yeah, in the no-gi stuff, it's been pretty good for the guys. I always kind of hope that like maybe there's like a way to like a set of shorts or something that I could stick it in and maybe they could pull it off of their leg or, you know, femoral artery.
Yeah, I mean, it is kind of mind-boggling to me. We're in, you know, 2024 and the core chest strap that Polar invented in the late 70s is basically the same. I mean, the materials are a bit better. Obviously, that's got memory and it's got Bluetooth. It's got that kind of stuff. But there's the, you know, it really hasn't been replaced as the core most accurate way to measure heart rate in 30, you know, plus years, or more, 50 years actually. So I don't know. Maybe eventually they'll get there and they'll. I mean, there are companies that make like pads that stick on your skin. There are companies that have implants or shit like that. But it's super impractical. It's super expensive. You know, there's just nothing that beats the accuracy of a chest strap at this point. And if you want to, you know, actually use data, you can be reliant on, you want something accurate. I mean, imagine if you were lifting weights and you had no idea it was on the bar, and the bar, it might tell you it's 120 when it's actually 150. And that's what's happening when you're doing heart rate monitoring on things that are inaccurate. Like, you just have no idea how hard you're actually pushing and you're getting bad data. You know, you end up making bad decisions or just not getting enough data to make real good decisions on because it's bullshit.
Yeah. What about misconceptions? Like, you know, you've been on this zone two and really just kind of conditioning based like longer than a lot of people. I mean, I remember like your newsletter on like 8 weeks out in the book and all that. It's like, what are some of the misconceptions that you've come into? What about diet? Like, you know, you need a ton of carbohydrates, you need no carbohydrates. I see both sides of this from the endurance thing that like, you know, if you get a fat adapted and ketogenic diet, you can build aerobic base. And then when we talked to like the guy from USA Sprint Triathlon, he's like, fuck, dude, these guys are consuming carbs at like a disgusting amount. They can't consume enough. And it's really the glycolytic capacity.
Yeah, I mean, diet's an interesting thing. So I mean, there's if we're talking like diet for health, longevity, and sustainability, like there's so many individual.
I don't give a fuck about all that shit. No, I'm while I know a lot of people probably listen to podcasts or in that, dude, like I'm so geeked out on athletic performance on that side.
So I mean, yeah, performance. If you're doing endurance sports, you're doing something lactic, you need fucking carbs. Like there's no way around that. Like I had a few athletes in the combat side try a keto and try a carnivore or whatever, like they perform like shit. Like you cannot, in my experience, maybe there are people that can, but in my experience, endurance athletes, combat athletes, people that are producing lactic output, you need carbs because that's what is breaking down. Like the lactic system is breaking down carbohydrates, it's breaking down glucose and stored glycogen. If you're not eating carbs, you have a much lower capacity to functionally do that and your performance is going to suffer. And I've had two or three guys that like they were convinced that they were going to go do the keto and they're going to perform well in combat sports, and they were wrong. They gassed out. And I said, "Told you." I've just not seen personally people in high intensity power output sports that rely on breakdown of glucose as the primary energy source perform particularly well in sports where that's what they have to do to perform. Now, if you're talking, I don't know, pure endurance sports, maybe some people have been successful with fat adapted ketogenic diets, but by and large, the majority of endurance athletes, in my opinion, experience, they all eat a shit ton of carbs. And there's probably a good reason for that. If endurance athletes performed really well in ketogenic diet, they'd all be on ketogenic diets by now because everybody knows what everyone's doing and everyone's tried everything. And there's probably a reason that every endurance athlete's not on a ketogenic diet. We're not on a high fat diet.
Well, when, so I'll, I do like some cyclical kind of carb loading deal. Like I'll go kind of low carb for 3 days and then the fourth day carb, like do like a carb refeed.
Yeah, I think that kind of stuff makes sense. That's part of adapting, as a whole.
That's just like body composition shit. That's just like straight up old school bodybuilding. But it's pretty interesting when I track HRV and when I do like in the morning, the next morning after the day of carb loading, like I can be as many as like 20 points higher. Like if I'm like in the 50s, 54, those first couple of days, then all of a sudden I'll be in the 70s and 80s. And
So one thing I'd say that's a point of that is if you look at data on depleting glycogen and then doing high intensity work, it's massively more inflammatory, way more inflammatory. It's just a greater stress on the body. The body does not really like being glycogen depleted. It's one of the things that triggers a whole bunch of cascades of the body to protect against that and produce energy more efficiently. It's part of how you actually become better at burning fat. As you deplete glycogen, you have to burn more fat. And the body's like, shit, I don't want to deplete glycogen, so I'll get better at burning fat. It doesn't like being low carb. It protects against that. So if you're constantly low carb, you just end up producing a lot more inflammation and HRV gets lower. Yeah. So I just don't see, now again, there could be reasons for cycling for body comp. There are reasons to train on low carb to purposely develop that intentionally, but training consistently at high intensity and low carbs, it's just a bad idea. I don't think it's effective. It creates more inflammation. Your performance is going to be shittier. Like it's not a good idea.
What other factors have you seen drive HRV, like supplements? I mean, obviously sleep's a major driver, zone two work. I'm just wondering what other factors kind of play in there.
I mean, like I said, sleep's a huge one. Hydration's a huge one. Anything that's driving inflammation up or down is a huge one. So really interesting test you can try to see if you have some sort of low-grade chronic inflammation. Take some NSAIDs. Take naproxen for a couple of days, which is an anti-inflammatory. If you see a big increase in your HRV, it means you probably have some chronic low-grade inflammation because that anti-inflammatory caused a big increase. So stuff, like I said, that your body doesn't react well to because of your gut microbiome or just your food allergies, you'll see that drop people pretty consistently. Lots of caffeine, I'm not talking like normal levels of caffeine, but high stimulant use all the time is going to drop your HRV because you're literally turning that parasympathetic system off and making the sympathetic more dominant through those stimulants. Those can decrease HRV if you're drinking coffee every hour on an hour and a drip. Things that vasodilate, L-arginine and things that are the opposite of that can increase it a bit. You're talking not huge amounts on the supplement side. It's really more like the extremes. If you have a very high food supplement or food allergy, you'll definitely see that tank you. Something you just don't digest well. If you're lactose intolerant, you have a bunch of lactose, that's going to tank you. But for the most part, it's the big factor that we talked about, sleep and mental stress and everything else will have the biggest impact. And those things, other things are very individual.
Nice. So what's the future for Morpheus? I mean, I know you guys just came out with a 2.0 and, obviously I've used the first one. How does that really like affect, obviously the user? And I'm always fascinated too by who the people are that are using it. A lot of people just seem to be, mid 30s, 40s, trying to be fitter, trying to be better versions of themselves. And what's nice is it actually gives out guidelines for the training and like different energy systems to hit, which isn't something anybody really does for other HRV systems.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, my whole idea with it was like, let's take the data that people are getting from other wearables and make it useful for them and actually translate that into, here's what you should do. From a training standpoint, it's like you mentioned right now, Morpheus gives you an HRV score, gives you a recovery score, and then it tells you each week how many minutes you should spend each one of your heart rate zones. And the way that we built that was just by looking at thousands of Morpheus users and millions of data points and doing what I talked about earlier. We said, hey, people that increase their aerobic fitness over 12-week periods tended to fall in these ranges of these different heart rate zones per week. And that's really what we looked at versus people who didn't get any better. They tended to fall in these ranges. And so we looked at the distribution of how many minutes in each heart rate zone that people, got better at. And that's how we use that to guide people. So we look at where you're starting and we say other people that look like you, they got better over 12 week periods. This is how many minutes they spent in our heart rate zones per week. And then we look at your recovery each week. We look at whether or not we see your fitness improving and we make adjustments weekly based on whether or not things are getting better. So that's really kind of step one of like, let's give people a roadmap of how many minutes they should spend in different heart rate zones to build their aerobic system over time. The progression from that moving forward is going to be giving people actual workouts they can do of different minutes in different intensity zones to fill those workouts or to fill that goal for the week. And then eventually we'll just have programs that'll be able to be delivered in there. Either you as a coach could deliver programs in Morpheus for your clients, or you could use the Morpheus, buy programs through Morpheus. We want to just kind of keep evolving that, help people know what to do on a daily and weekly basis to improve their cardiovascular fitness, which is, and recovery at the same time. So the more data we get, the more people we get in the system, the more we can invest in these sorts of tools to give people workouts and programs and everything else that are built on their own physiology. And that's the biggest thing I would say for anybody who's like, why should I use HRV? Because you're different than everybody else. Your genetics are different. Your lifestyle is different. Your training history is different. You are an individual. And if you're just going about your day making workouts up out of thin air or following somebody else's Instagram workout, and you have no idea how your body is actually going to respond, you're going to make a lot slower progress, and you're probably going to spend time doing things that aren't productive. So HRV just helps you figure out how your body responds, what volumes, intensity you need, and what your recovery looks like based on different diets, based on how well you sleep, based on, you know, your lifestyle. You really have to dial in your own coaching, your own training. There's no way around that. And that's where HRV becomes a really powerful tool. And so that's ultimately what Morpheus is going to help people do, is just get better at coaching themselves and understanding how these things impact them and figuring out how many minutes they should spend in different heart rate zones, and just make sure that we're giving people the tools they need to know what they should be doing, and make sure they spend time doing that and avoid doing the things that are a waste of their time or counterproductive.
What is your favorite conditioning implement? Like, for example, I love the Echo Bike. We use that because it's all concentric. I don't have to worry about much eccentric load. But what do you dig on?
I actually like the Kaiser M3 bike a lot because it's magnetic resistance. Same thing. You can dial the resistance up. You can dial resistance down. It's a good bike. I like the VersaClimber for higher intensity work because it's low impact.
I just threw up in my mouth.
The VersaClimber.
I just threw up in my mouth. We used to have three of the VersaClimbers, and I got to the point where I just fucking sold them because I hated using them so much.
Yeah. I mean, like, so they're good for higher intensity stuff. I wouldn't use them for zone two for hours on end. I like the Kaiser elliptical. I like the, I do like the Rogue bikes. I have a Woodway Force. A little Woodway Force is awesome. Most people don't have those, but those are super good. I like the Endless Rope, which is a underutilized piece of equipment, especially for upper body grappling. Endless Rope is sweet because you can dial up the resistance, you can track distance, you can look at heart rate, you can do a bunch of stuff for upper body pulling, which is a really hard thing to do cardiovascular wise, and you can do that with Endless Rope really well. Those are probably my main go-tos, I would say.
Nice. Well, dude, I don't have any more questions. So I wrote all my questions. Just trying to think of what other shit we can bullshit or we can call it there.
You got anything else? I mean, your audience is all athletic, I assume, right? Or mostly athletic?
You know what? We got a mix of a lot of athletes, but it feels like as of late, we have a lot of late 20s, early 30s, even into their 40s-year-old dudes that are training in their garage that, you know, are former athletes that still want to train at a high level. So I think that there's, it's really fascinating that like now there's this whole talk of like, not whole talk, but like the idea of like longevity and like, whether it be, you know, Gabrielle Lyon talking about like muscle. I mean, I've been beating this fucking war drum for a long time that like, you know, people that carry more muscle tend to be more useful, stronger, and like live more durable lives. So however I can do to preserve muscle. And I always thought that the zone two stuff was bullshit. And I think that maybe that was just thumbing my nose at like, you know, coaches, you know, active recovery and just some of the shit we did in the NFL I thought was useless. Like nobody ever sat down and explained to me like, hey, you need a big aerobic base so you can recover better in between efforts. And so I looked at it like, I'm going to lift heavy weights. I'm going to sprint as fast as I can for as many reps, you know, and kind of in that Charlie Francis deal where you're either doing the kind of the recovery tempo runs or you're running in that higher register. So as we've gotten into this new, you know, this market, I get hit up by a lot of people that are, you know, former athletes that still want to train in an athletic way and they still want to be useful. The zone two stuff didn't really hit me until, God, this is probably about 10 years ago. We had like the guys that were working for me, we kind of had just an office pool. We actually like all kind of like pulled out of a hat and I had to lose 10% of my body weight. Two of us had to lose 10, two of the other guys had to gain 10. And I was like, well, let's go get some bod pod stuff done. So we got a bod pod, we got DEXA scans. They got to choose their training and then we just picked, I think it was like 12 or 14 weeks. And I was like, hey, this is how long. Everybody hit their numbers, but I was stuck. I couldn't get my body weight down. So I just started doing all this zone two work, because every time we'd go to the gym, we would see these fitness girls just sprinting up and down the step mill. And like, these chicks were shredded. And I was like, man, I've watched them lift weights. I don't know what they eat. They're probably on like cocaine and cigarettes, but like, they're fucking like killing this thing for an hour. So I was like, you know what? Like, if you want to get strong, look at what the big, strong dude's doing. I'm going to figure out what these fitness models are doing. So I would get on this the step mill thing. And I'd do like 45, 50, 60 minutes on this. And I was doing it every day, trying to get my body weight down to hit this 10%. And then all of a sudden, like 4 weeks, 5 weeks later, I deadlifted like 585 for like a set of 10. I had never pulled 585 for a set of 10. I was like PRing every lift. I was in caloric restriction. My body weight's down. And the only difference in the training was I was doing all this aerobic work trying to lose weight. And I was like, oh, shit. And I went back and read all this stuff. And I was like, man, this is I think I really fucked up. I missed this entire part of the course. And so ever since then, I've started putting like a big emphasis on this aerobic work. And when I started training in Victor and Philippe and the guys for BJJ, one of the things that was interesting when I threw the Morpheus on them, like, they were never in these zones. We were either lifting weights or they were in this, like, it was weird. They were like not in that kind of zone two. It was either like zone one or higher up. So when we started kind of going in and dipping into that pool, I saw some really interesting changes in not only body composition, but they started carrying more muscle. I felt that they were processing their food better, and just like all the autonomic systems just kind of came online a lot better. And it's kind of frustrating now, like, seeing all my mistakes, but trying to cure them for other people, and then being like, fuck. Like, I just had an NFL kid here for 6 weeks who's going into his contract year. And like, kind of like giving him all these pieces and being like, hey man, here's the stuff you need to work on that I purposely avoided because I was stubborn and I didn't want to believe anybody. But also there was no, you know, the internet wasn't as like robust as it is today. So the ability to move around this information, you know, you're talking about 2004, 2005, 2006. I mean, fuck, like sending an email and really just that information just wasn't available.
Yeah. I mean, I think perspectives have definitely changed significantly. Here's one thing for people to consider too, is they found that people that have higher aerobic fitness maintain muscle mass better as they age. Why? Because probably what happens is as you age, it's not that you produce less energy, it's that it takes a greater toll on your body, become less metabolically efficient. So if you're carrying a bunch of muscle mass around, your body doesn't really want to, because it's very metabolically expensive to carry muscle mass around, right? Muscle mass takes a lot of calories to maintain. And as you're aging, if you're not very metabolically fit, meaning aerobically fit, your muscle mass will start to decrease because your body doesn't want to carry it around because it's expensive and it doesn't want to. So they found that people that are much more active and have higher VO2s maintain muscle mass as they age much better than somebody who's not doing that sort of aerobic work. Endurance athletes maintain their muscle mass, even though they have less of it, they maintain that muscle mass better because metabolically, they become more effective and more efficient at supplying the energy those muscles need to, you know, to stay around and to maintain it. So there are a lot of reasons to develop the aerobic system, even if you don't do a sport that's an endurance sport. If you don't do anything that's massively demanding from an aerobic standpoint, you still want to have a high VO2 because it will help you preserve that muscle mass that you've spent so many years building. And if you lose that because you have a low VO2, which you're not thinking of, then, you know, you made a mistake because you built a bunch of muscle that your body didn't want to maintain as you got older. But before we go here, I'll talk about something that I think is important, just because I've been going through this on a personal standpoint. So one thing I want to point out for everybody is strength training by itself is probably not going to prevent a heart attack. And a third of the population is going to have a heart attack, statistically speaking. I don't know how many people you know in the lifting community, the athletic community, have had heart attacks.
It's I want to say 95% of men in this country will either die of one of two things, either cancer or heart attack.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and so, real quick personal story, my family history is really bad. So my dad had a heart attack in his late 50s, had a double bypass, and died in his early 60s. My grandpa's on both sides died early 60s, heart attacks. My brother had stents put in his heart when he was 44. He died in a motorcycle crash, but he probably would have had a heart attack at some point if he had made it that far. So I've known this my whole life. My family history is shit. My mom had a stroke in her 60s. Like, my family, if you're a woman, a female, you get a stroke. If you're a male, you get a heart attack. Like, that's just how it is. And so I've, you know, been in the fitness industry my whole life. I've lifted weights since I was 13, you know, 3 to 6 days per week. Like, I think I've maybe taken a couple weeks off and that's it for my entire life. And in my 20s, I really got in the cardiovascular side stuff too. And I've done blood work since my 30s, looking at LDL, looking at HDL, looking at cholesterol, triglyceride numbers, pretty much everything. And my numbers have always been pretty good, like in the normal range, in the low normal healthy range, all my numbers have looked good. And so when I went to take my mom to the cardiologist in her 40s or my 30s, when she had a stroke and she had stents put in herself, you know, I asked the cardiologist, what should I be doing? And he looked at my blood numbers and he was like, oh, your numbers look really good. You know, all of these are normal ranges. They look great. You're healthy. You work out all the time. Come back and see me when you're 40. We can talk about more preventative stuff and do more work basically to see where you're at. Well, 40 comes around, it's COVID. So I'm not going to go into a doctor to do preventative stuff in the middle of COVID. Then my mom passed away. Long story short, I didn't see the COVID or didn't see the cardiologist till I was 44, which I am now. I have more blood work, looks at my blood work. He's like, oh, your blood work's great. Everything looks good. Did an EKG. Heart looks great. I said, well, based on my family history, I want to get a CT angiogram. Mm-hmm. All right. For those of you who don't know, a CT angiogram is a scan of your heart blood vessels with contrast dyes. So they can see what's going on in your blood vessels. And so he's like, well, all indications are you probably don't need one, but it's not a bad idea. You know, insurance isn't going to pay for it. It's about $1,500. But if you want to go do it, given your family history, I support that. It's probably, you know, probably a good idea. And if you want to pay for it, go do it. So I go do it, thinking, of course, I'm a lifelong exerciser. I don't drink. I don't smoke. I eat well. I have blockages, pretty significant coronary blockages in my arteries, 25 to 50% in my LAD, which is the Widowmaker, 20%, a couple other ones. And the more I've dug into this, it's because I have really shitty genetics. So my blood vessels have genetics that make them much more susceptible to atherosclerosis and basically much more inflammatory. And they suck up as much cholesterol as they possibly can. And my HDL is not super high to help offset that. And so even though my blood numbers have been normal my entire life, and I've worked out my entire life, I've at 45, almost 45 now, have atherosclerosis and heart disease, which is crazy to me. And so the more I started talking to cardiologists, the more I start talking to the radiologist who does nothing but heart scans all day long, the more I think that we have to be aware that just because you lift weights and you're strong or you do cardio, it's not in and of itself enough if you have bad family history and genetics to overcome it. It's definitely played a role in helping me. It's why I don't have to have stents now. My brother did, and it'll definitely decrease my risk of having a heart attack. But I think we make a mistake in the fitness community of thinking like, oh, I'm healthy because I lift weights and because I do cardio, I can't have heart disease. I'm not going to have a heart attack. There's a very high likelihood that you still could if you have very bad family history. And the radiologist who does nothing but look at CTAs all day long tells me on a weekly basis, they have somebody coming in who's a lifelong exerciser. They have people come in who are marathon runners. They have people come in who are high level strength athletes and different types of sports. And they have heart attacks. And when I was there, she had a marathon runner have to be sent immediately to the emergency room to have stents put in his 50s, like early 50s. So I say this just because I even fell in the trap and I went the extra mile, right? I did blood work for 10 plus years. I talked to cardiologists. All my numbers were normal. And I still have a genetic defect in my arteries that's causing me to accumulate plaque at a much faster rate than it should be. Now, it doesn't mean that somebody else is in my situation is going to have the same result. Maybe they have great genetics. It doesn't matter. So I just point this out because after talking to the cardiologists and the radiologists and all these people, you know, it's clear that strength training is important for a lot of reasons. It's very important. But just because you lift weights and you feel like you're fit doesn't mean that you don't have to pay attention to your cardiovascular fitness or that you're not going to get a heart attack. And I've had, I don't know about you, I've had several friends in the strength community die in their 50s. I was at Mel Stiff's house 2 weeks before he had a heart attack and died. Charles Poliquin had heart problems and died. Yep. There's endless people. Angry Coach from Elite FCS, a good friend of mine, Bob Illenfelt, he died of an embolism like in his 40s. So this shit happens all the time. So I just think we have to be aware that lifting weights and doing cardiovascular work is hugely important. It mitigates our risk. It helps us in endless ways. But if you have bad family history of cardiovascular disease, stroke, these sorts of things, it's really important to be proactive and be aware. Because I wish I would have caught this 10 years ago. I probably could have prevented the accumulation of blockage and damage.
What,
but it's really you think like,
how
oh,
would you
I'm healthy,
change
I'm fit, I don't need to do this shit. But you do if you have bad family history. That's ultimately what it comes down to. Family history matters a huge fucking amount. If you have bad family history, be very, very aware of it and be very proactive. So that's my message for the day.
How could you have changed it 10 years ago, you think?
I would have had to get a CTA probably 10 years ago to see that, because it wasn't, like I said, it didn't show up in blood tests. My cholesterol, my LDL was 100. HRC, my sensitivity, my CRP was normal. You know, all my numbers were normal. So the only way you could have seen it was either get a calcium test, which is about $150 test. I might have shown up with some calcium back in my 30s, but the CTA, the full CT angiogram, would have shown it. And here's the shitty part. It's $1,500. Insurance doesn't pay for it. Yeah. And if I hadn't been proactive enough to just go spend the money and get the CTA, I didn't think I needed it. My cardiologist said he didn't think it was necessary. He's like, it's a good idea, but he wouldn't prescribe it because everything looked good. Mm. And if I had not spent that $1,500, I would almost guarantee you I had a heart attack in the next 5-10 years. Almost guarantee it, because I have atherosclerosis and it would just have kept accumulating. So it's really shitty that, you know, I'm pretty rare. I don't think most people have the ability to have the blood levels normal like I do and still accumulate plaque like I have. But you look at my family history, it makes sense. Like, all of my family was fit. My dad had a heart attack playing basketball. My mom was the flight attendant, walked all over the goddamn place and had a stroke. Both my grandpas were fit. Like, none of my family was unfit, overweight, unhealthy. Most of them didn't drink or smoke a whole lot. One couple of them smoked, but, you know, they had a heart attack in their 50s and 60s. So I saw that, and that's now a clear reason why that's the case. But talking to cardiovascular surgeons, talking to vascular surgeons, a lot of strength training is the whole topic. A lot of strength training. I'm not saying normal amount of strength training. A lot of strength training probably exacerbates people like me. Because
is,
you're
is that because like the athlete heart? Blood. Like the athlete
What's
heart?
That?
Like the athlete heart? Where they were
it's not the athlete heart. It's more like the athlete arteries. So if you have arteries like mine, that are more likely to be pro-inflammatory, they're more likely to have endothelial damage. High blood pressures, which is a lot of heavy lifting, causes some damage to arterial walls and high volumes, or likely does in people like me. It makes you more susceptible for those arteries to harden, and it can have some negative effects on the heart itself. And it's causing lots of shear force on the blood or on the arterial walls from just the turbulence of the blood that's in the system. So there's a few papers out now where they've looked at athletes. There's two big papers. MARC1, which is measuring athletes' risk of cardiovascular events, one, and MARC2, where they measured 300 athletes and people that are lifelong trainers and lifelong athletes, and looked at rates of cardiovascular disease, progression, all kinds of stuff. There's another one came out, looked at all these different factors they think might be accelerating. They're finding that in lifelong athletes and very high volume people, they have higher levels of atherosclerosis than the average human being does at their age match control, which is crazy, considering they probably are living better lifestyles. But there's probably something going on that can accelerate atherosclerosis at very high train volumes in people that are genetically susceptible to that. There's also great cardiovascular protective effects that happen at the same time, so it mitigates some of it, but it's still there. So it's just something to be aware of. Again, I just want to,
yeah,
just because I wish I had, you know, spent $1,500 10 years earlier, but I didn't even know about the test back then. It wasn't very commonly used. It became much more commonly used after COVID, actually. So I would just say, if you have the advice, I would say, because this is what I've been talking to cardiovascular surgeons about and cardiologists, if you're in your like mid to late 30s and you have a bad family history, go get a calcium scan. It's like $150, $100, depending on where you get it. That calcium scan is a low grade CT. It just does not use a contrast dye, and they'll give you a score. If your score is zero, it means you don't have any hard calcified plaque in your system. I mean, you could still have soft plaque, but you don't have hard calcified plaque. If you're in your 40s and you can afford a CTA and you have bad family history, go get a CTA. It's that simple. It's a one. If you show up clear, you spent $1,500, now you have some peace of mind. You don't have clogged arteries. You don't have atherosclerosis. Great. But if you find something, then you can be much more proactive about your 40s than wait until you're in your 50s or 60s or you have a heart attack. So, you know, again, I don't want to scare people, but I'm just want to point out, as someone that's in this industry my whole life and known a lot of people in the industry their whole life that have died from this and will die from this, it's a mistake to think that just because you lift weights and you do cardio and you eat right that you're immune from it. Because if you have bad family history and you have the wrong genetics, you're not.
Or that personally, so. The other factor would be excessive steroid use. I mean,
100%. Yeah, 100%. Like, that has to accelerate it.
I mean, the we would get drug tested a ton. I mean, in the NFL, I think at one point it was like 24 to 36 times a year you're getting tested. So when I would go to the gym, and I didn't, you know, and this is also kind of cool, and that, you know, you play in the NFL, you kind of train. And I went to like Athletes Performance, and you train other places. But when you go to like normal gyms, like you'd see dudes that you knew were taking drugs just because they were like big bodybuilders. And I used to train in Orange County a bunch, and there were dudes that were, you know, big fucking strong guys that you knew that was the sport they did. I feel like today through social media, like every one of these kids is taking drugs. Like I saw something, or somebody sent me something. This like 14-year-old kid is like, I'm on trend, and he's like 14, and I'm like,
crazy.
I was like, Jesus Christ! Like I am amazed at the amount of people that are taking drugs, and more importantly, like not just a little bit, but like massive fucking amounts at this age. I mean,
the problem is like you don't see the effects till decades later. That's the fucking problem. Like in the short term, you're like, oh, I'm jacked. I'm faster, I'm stronger, I'm leaner, I feel amazing. It's the decades later that you don't give a shit about right now where you're paying the cost for that. And if I had used a bunch of anabolic steroids, I probably would fucking be dead by now. I probably would have already had a heart attack. But there's a reason that, you know, athletes that are abusing drugs and doing stupid shit, like we see a heart attacks. I mean, how many people do you play with? I'm sure you know people you played with that have had heart problems. And if you haven't, they will get there because it's 50s and 60s where the price comes due of, you know, what you did in your 20s and 30s, unfortunately. So
I wonder with like a lot of like the Toradol and the anti-inflams. So we've been working a bunch with this gal who's a gut biome researcher. And she was talking about like different anti-inflammatories and different drugs as they affect the gut, which ends up leading to cardiovascular problems and everything that you see this downstream effect. But
yeah, it's all tied together.
Yeah. I mean, it's really fascinating too in the training space because I think people compartmentalize things. Like we think about everything exists in a vacuum and it's not the case. Like the system as a whole, I mean, you know, all of a sudden, you know, you have shitty fucking periodontal work and all of a sudden you have gum disease, you brush your teeth and, you know, you get cuts. And now they're finding that the microbes from the mouth are the ones that are driving heart attacks because they're finding the same microbes in the mouth that they are in the heart.
Yeah, absolutely. My wife's dad's a dentist and he's been able to like literally predict people having heart attacks based on what he saw in their dental work. So there's absolutely a relationship between all these things. And then the inflammation is the commonality here. You have inflammation in your mouth and you have microbes that are related to inflammation, you have them elsewhere. Yeah. And so a lot of it's just this pro-inflammatory state. And exercise is a pro-inflammatory state. And it's a good pro-inflammatory state as long as you can turn that inflammation off and use that inflammation to adapt and become better. But when you have this chronic inflammatory state from too much training, too much high blood pressure work, too much stuff, and your body can't shut it off, whether it's because you're doing too much, you just have shitty genetics, that's when you pay the price. You know, against it's not right now, it's not tomorrow, it's not next month, might not be next year, but those things accumulate over, you know, decades. And I've been lifting like that since I was 13. And they did one of the follow-up papers I mentioned. They looked at people that did really high intensity training. They call it like max vigorous intensity or whatever they called it in five categories of working out. They saw the highest rates of progressive atherosclerosis. The people that just did higher volume, lower intensity stuff didn't. They saw much slower rates of progression over this I think 7 or 10 year period. So high intensity seems to be more likely the driver of some of these things, probably just because it's high blood pressure. Very high blood pressure, very high blood flow causes shear force in the walls. And again, this isn't going to be for everybody. A lot of people, it won't have any negative effects unless it's in crazy volumes. But for some people like myself who just have bad endothelial genetics and bad vascular issues, like it creates probably some exacerbates it a bit. I mean, I'm not saying it caused it, but it could definitely sped it up.
Well, so what about something
to be aware of?
What about like the, you know, I mean, I feel like hit training kind of goes through cycles. Like all of a sudden it was like, you know, let's say 15 years ago, I mean, CrossFit and like, you know, Jim Jones and all these people that were, you know, training in these like upper registers and the idea that you got to go 100% every day and rinse and repeat. That type of, you know, and I always stress when you think about it, like maybe when you first start training, you know, going and doing it, like maybe the first couple weeks, like you're probably hitting fucking pretty close, damn near high heart rate. But then after a while, your body kind of accommodates. And next thing you know, you're going as hard as you can, sure, but you're never able to get your heart rate up a bunch. But for people that are training in that high intensity, I mean, based off the Morpheus thing, it's like 4 to 7 minutes a week. is really.
Yeah, you because we basically found that people did a lot of it, didn't get better. Their HRV got worse. The resting heart rate got worse. And that's what the data showed. And we analyzed, we broke people up into categories based on their resting heart rate and HRV to start with. And I think we used three or four categories of fitness level based on that. We looked at 12-week periods across the year and, again, looked at what percentage they were spending these different intensities. The people that spent the highest amount of time in the highest intensities got worse. At best, they didn't get any better. The people that spent the lower amounts of the higher intensity and the larger percentage of their work at lower intensities and just spent more time doing low volume or higher volume, low intensity, they're the ones whose numbers improved. So I'm not saying that's across the board for every type of fitness or every person, but people that had these crazy numbers, like we had people in there who were spending like 70 or 80% of their volume at like 85 and 100% of their max heart rate, 85 to 100%. They got worse. Like they got significantly worse. Their heart rates, or their average HRV and their average resting heart rate went the wrong direction. So the average person just can't recover from that. Even in like fairly small daily doses, like I just don't think high intensity, true high intensity. And I would say that's probably above 90% of max heart rate. I just don't think you can recover from that very well. And I think it can have, you know, negative effects when you do it over time. And most people in the powerlifting world wouldn't go do a max effort squat and deadlift every day. Even if it's two reps, you wouldn't do that because it would trash your nervous system eventually.
Well,
so to think you can get your heart rate up maximally every day is probably not a good idea either.
Well, one of the issues we kept seeing is that when people came in and did a lot of the HIIT type training and let's say like something mixed modal like CrossFit, there was like a pretty good adaptation phase where they all like, you know, tended to look better and all of a sudden like looked a little bit leaner and like they like you could see physical improvements. And then all of a sudden they hit a point where all of a sudden they looked like they had more systemic inflammation, like they were carrying more fat and they just weren't able to recover. And I remember I remember having people and being like, and they were like, you know, and then all of a sudden I got to dial everything in. I got to get this. I got to train more. And I remember being like, I think you just need to lift some weights and do some zone two work and a little active recovery and like almost periodize in this thing, like do 3 months on, 3 months off. And for the most part, once we switched people over to just lifting weights and doing a little bit of aerobic work and getting out and walking and like all of a sudden everybody's body composition improved. It was it was interesting to see people. I mean, but then – if you look at like the CrossFit Games competitors, right? Those dudes are all jacked and this is what they do for their training. But if you were to put heart rate monitors on those guys are never working in the upper registers because they're efficient and they've done so much work to get there.
Exactly. And your body can accommodate a lot for a while. I mean, you can get away with a lot of shit for a certain period of time, but eventually the body cannot keep going. It's dedicating so many resources to trying to just deal with all the stress you're putting on it. Eventually, the cost for that comes due. And even the Tabata study that everyone loves to talk about, the initial like, oh, Tabata, they got better results than the people who did lower intensity work. They did, but it plateaued in the second 3 weeks of study. It improved for 3 weeks and then plateaued for 3 weeks. Their VO2 went up really quickly for 3 weeks and then it stayed same. The second half of the study, the VO2 did not improve. The lower intensity group improved slower, of course, but it improved across the entire 6 week period. And that is kind of this trade-off between intensity and time in a nutshell. If you want to do really high intensity work, your time to see that improvement is going to come much shorter, but it's going to also plateau much shorter. And you can't just keep leveling up intensity indefinitely as the only dial you turn, because if you're already at maximum, what are you going to do? You can't keep going up from high intensity. You're already high intensity. So the only thing you can do at that point is to try to do more of it. And more of it is going to be something that your body can't sustain. So
where does age fit into this? I mean, I feel like for the BJJ kids that I train that are in their 20s, they're like fucking rubber. Like it's amazing to see.
You can get away with a lot, right? But you're still probably accumulating some damage. I think the combat athletes who beat the shit out of themselves in their 20s, they're the ones who have careers that they fall apart in the MMA or in the UFC or whatever level in their early 30s or late 20s even, because they just accumulated damage and that all starts to not ache and get painful until their late 20s, early 30s. Then they start to see it happen, or maybe they get to the mid 30s. But a lot of the early MMA guys, like in their 40s and 50s now, like they can barely walk. Like I know a lot of them, like they are beat to shit because they did that shit for way too long. So the older you get, the more you just realize the cost of the things you did when you're younger, and the more you have to really pay attention to recovery, because it slows down as your hormones decrease, your testosterone, your growth hormone, all the anabolic drive, as that starts to slow down, your recovery just takes a hit. And you can either be smart about it and start dialing things back and doing less and listen to your body, or you can keep trying to do what you did in your 20, in which case your recovery is just going to get even worse. So, you know, it's sooner or later people pay the price, and you listen to your body and you learn, hopefully, and then you make course corrections.
Nice. Well, dude, if people want to learn more, how do they, like, where do they go? How do they get it? And more importantly, how do they kind of dig in on this?
Yeah, 8weeksout.com. Just the number 8weeksout.com is my main website. They can look at articles. I got free courses. I got a certification with coaches out there, all that kind of stuff. And then if they want to learn more about Morpheus, that's trainwithmorpheus.com. That's where you can learn more about the Morpheus system. So either one of those two is a good option. Coach Joel Jameson on IG. And any of those, they can find out more about what I'm up to, what we're working on with Morpheus, go through courses I've got for free on there, and pretty much everything in between.
Cool. Awesome, dude. Thanks for coming on Power Athlete Radio, dude. And it's nice to finally get a cap on this, but also to say, man, it's been cool to have the Morpheus and be able to use it with the guys. So thank you.
Yeah, no problem. Glad to come on, and I'm sure we'll chat again down the road.
Sounds good. Thank you. Hey there, Power Athlete Nation. Big shout out to all the heavy hitters who stuck around till the final whistle. If you've been soaking in the knowledge bombs and epic tales you've been dropping for free, here's your chance to be a game changer. Swing by ko-fi.com/powerathlete and toss a few bucks our way to keep the podcast fueled and firing on all cylinders. That's ko-fi.com/powerathlete. Your support makes a difference. See ya.